Good evening, Ajahn Jayasaro and members of the Mahasangha. My name is Brother Ui. Brothers and sisters in the Dhamma, welcome to BGF. And I understand that among the audience are also people from Thailand. So allow me to say Sawadi. I think it's right. Just a brief introduction of Ajahn before we start. Ajahn born in the Isles of Wight, England, in 1958, and he was then called Sean Shipperton. He has done a lot of traveling, and one of the places he went to was in India, where then he acquired the interest in the Eastern religion and, of course, meditation as well. And in 1978, he visited the homestead Vihara, and from there on, he became an Anagarika, spending vasa with Ajahn Sumedho. And later on, he proceeded to Thailand and received the Upasampada from the late Ajahn Chah in 1980. And Ajahn was the former abbot of Wat Pa Nanachat until the year 2002. So currently, Ajahn is the abbot of the Hermitage in Korat, where the SEA Games is now being held. And this evening, Ajahn shall share with us on the topic of suffering and karma, core of Buddhism. And with that, we'd like to invite Ajahn to commence the talk. Thank you.
Now, throughout the Buddhist world, all the different traditions, I think it's generally acknowledged that the core teaching is that of the Four Noble Truths. And so, when we speak about suffering or dukkha, we always have to remember that it is the first of the Four Noble Truths, of course. And in the West, where the misinterpretations of Buddhism have sometimes outnumbered the interpretations of it, the emphasis on dukkha or suffering as being the distinctive Buddhist teaching led many commentators to portray Buddhism as a very pessimistic teaching, indeed a nihilistic one. And even in the Encyclopedia Britannica and many very well-known, reputable works of reference, Nibbana would be explained as being an absolute extinction. So you can imagine that this didn't endear many people to the Theravada Buddhist teachings. The word suffering itself is more or less a compromise translation. Translators, students of Pali, have been shaking their heads for years about how to translate this word dukkha into English, and finally decided on suffering as probably the least bad of all the possibilities, or the one that gives least suffering to the translators. I myself prefer to use the Pali word dukkha, and the reason for this is that the word suffering, as is often commented upon, leads to a rather narrow and distorted understanding of what the Buddha's talking about. So I would like to give my interpretation in a nutshell of what this word means. And my definition is not nibbana. So dukkha means not nibbana. Now, sometimes you read books on Buddhism and they say in Buddhism it teaches everything is dukkha. Well, if you think about that statement just for a moment, you'll see that it's a meaningless statement. It doesn't mean anything. If you say everything is dukkha, well, it's like saying everything is up or everything is. It's not saying anything at all. That statement would only have meaning when there's something which is not dukkha. And what is not dukkha is nibbana. And it's because the statement everything is dukkha, you know, is not strictly speaking correct, that we're all here together tonight, and that because there is a path out of dukkha. So my second suggestion for this term dukkha is a lack of true happiness. So if we put those two together, we can say that nibbana is true happiness. And there is a teaching of the Buddha where he puts it in those very words. He says, nibbanaṃ paramaṃ sukhaṃ, which means nibbana is the supreme happiness. Now, I think when we look at it this way, at least for me, it makes certain teachings a lot clearer. Sometimes we'll hear Buddhists saying, "Oh, he or she thinks they're happy, but they're not really happy," you know. Or even happiness is suffering. You know, that's often said, isn't it? Yeah, they say they're happy, but really they're suffering. They're not really happy. And so, of course, the person who's experiencing that emotions says, "Well, what's the difference between between being mistaken about being happy and being really happy? You know, isn't it good enough? You know?" And as Buddhists, we have an answer to that kind of question. So if we take dukkha to be meaning an absence or a lack of true happiness, next question is, well, is there such a thing as true happiness? And this is the third noble truth on the road. Yes, there is. And is it possible? Is it realizable for ordinary human beings like all of us to realize that true happiness of nibbana? And the Buddha says yes. So why, how is it possible? And it's because that lack, that absence of true happiness, of nibbana, is conditioned. It's not a curse. It's not something we've inherited through the mistaken actions of human beings thousands of years ago. It's not in the stars. It's due to our lack of understanding of the way things are. So I am, of course, talking around the Four Noble Truths here. So reformulating the Four Noble Truths, our experience of life is one characterized by a lack of a true enduring happiness. And that lack of true enduring happiness is due to a lack or an absence of understanding, which manifests as craving. That situation is not inevitable, it's not fixed, it's not something we have to try to come to terms with and to accept, but it's something that we can transcend. We can realize this true happiness through the Eightfold Path. Now, we can see that the Buddha started off with the human condition. He started off with the way things are. He started off with those aspects of the way things are which are immediately recognizable. He didn't start off with a very advanced and complex metaphysical system and then asked his followers to try to fit their experience into it. He didn't tell you how you should be, because the Buddha realized if you have a teaching consisting of instructions about what kind of person you should be, that the end result is that most people end up feeling guilty, that they're not how they should be. So the Buddha's starting off with how you are right now, and why is it like this? Does it have to be like this? If it doesn't, what are you going to do about it? So it's a very practical teaching. So it's as if the Buddha recognizes an expanse of water, and he points to this shore, and he says there's a shore over there, and to get from this shore to that shore, you have to build a bridge. So he recognized the water to be crossed, and then he built a bridge, rather than building a bridge and then finding some water to put under it. It's a topical example, perhaps. And the faith that we need as Buddhists is somewhat different from the faith that is expected of followers of theistic religions. And I think it's important that we are able to distinguish Buddhism from other teachings without saying we're right, they're wrong, we're better, they're worse, but in order to be very clear about why it is exactly that we're happy to be Buddhists and we consider this the path which is most fruitful and beneficial for us. And I've often divided the religions of the world into two main families, the family that grew up in the Middle East, and the religions that belong to that family we can characterize as belief systems. Belief, faith, is the central virtue in those systems, and indeed their religions are often referred to as faiths these days, this faith and that faith. So the word faith and the word religion, at least in the English language, have almost become interchangeable. And this is why Buddhism is often misunderstood and is often seen to be somewhat confusing, because it is not a belief system. You know, the first, and I think, really central point that we need to acknowledge is that Buddhism is a different kind of religion. It's a different family. It's a different species of religion. And it's not religion as belief system, but it's religion as education system. So some people say, is Buddhism a religion, or is it a way of life, or is it a philosophy, or is it this, or is it that, or is it a philosophically religious way of life, or is it a religious philosophy, or... And people spend hours and days and months going on. So we can talk about, yes, it's a religion, but it's a different kind of religion. It's an education system. And in this education system, faith has a certain role to play. But it is always mediated by wisdom. So wherever you come across the word satta in the Buddhist teachings, you'll notice it's always part of a group of dhammas or virtues. And if faith or satta is the first one, then wisdom will always be the last one. And we're constantly reminded to balance the two. So faith in Buddhism has to be overlooked, mediated, tempered by the critical faculty. And the Pali word that we chant, ehipasiko, come and see, means that we're open to challenge. You know, if you don't believe in this, it's fine. And you can put these teachings to the test, and you should do that. So faith has the role to play of clarifying our objectives and our path, and leading to effort or wirya. And faith in the Buddha's enlightenment is, in essence, faith in the enlightenment of a very special human being 2,500 years ago. But the implication of that faith, and that's faith in something that we have no means of proving, is the faith in the capacity of a human being to realize enlightenment, or to transcend dukkha and to realize the true happiness of nibbana. So we're looking into the meaning, the implications of the fundamental movement of faith in Buddhism. Faith in Buddhist enlightenment means faith in the human capacity for enlightenment. And the next step, and the crucial step following from that, is we have strong faith and confidence in our own capacity for enlightenment, every single one of us. So if somebody says, what do Buddhists believe in? You know, has anyone ever asked you that? What do Buddhists believe in? You say, well, we believe in our capacity to abandon the unwholesome. We believe in our capacity to develop the wholesome. We believe in our capacity to purify our minds. We, in other words, have a strong faith in our capacity to transcend dukkha and to realize nibbana. Now, even if in this lifetime we don't realize that aim, we take it as the duty, the responsibility, the motivation, the orientation of life, which gives meaning to every day, every hour, every minute, every breath that we have. There's that movement towards nibbana. Now, once we have the ultimate goal clearly in our sights, that is transcendence of dukkha, realization of nibbana, which means ultimate true happiness, which in turn means the complete absence of greed, hatred, and delusion, then we can now start talking about the middle way. And so what's the middle way? The middle way is the optimum practice. In any given situation, whether we're in a monastery, in a Dhamma center, when we're at home in the office, sitting in the car, that way of conducting ourselves through body, speech, and mind, which is most effective in reducing the defilements of greed, hatred, and delusion, and promoting the positive qualities of generosity and compassion and wisdom, that is the middle way for us at that moment, at that time. So dukkha, in the Four Noble Truths, dukkha as an arya satya, as a noble truth, can be transcended, should be transcended, should be transcended by me, must be transcended by me. This is the kind of progression that one follows in one's contemplation. So this is not a philosophy. We're not just accumulating sophisticated and inspiring ideas, but it's about our lives right now. And we can see very clearly, I think, in the present day, that high ideals and belief in noble things is not enough. Every single day, people are doing terrible things to other human beings in the name of very high ideals. So it's not what you believe, it's what you do. It's what you do with your mind, it's what you do with your body, it's what you do with your speech. In other words, it's your karma. So karma is action. Action of body, speech and mind. And it's the action which is characterized by intention. Intentional action is the heart of karma. So action of body, speech and mind inspired by defilements of greed, hatred and delusion we call very simply bad karma. And actions of body, speech and mind characterized by intentions of generosity, kindness and compassion, wisdom, are good karma. And so in our lives, the challenge moment by moment is how can we create as little bad karma as possible and create as much good karma as possible. So we can resolve all these incredibly complex teachings into some very, very, very simple challenges in our life. And I would ask you, don't be afraid of simplicity. Don't feel that the more complex an argument is, the better it is for you, or the more beneficial it necessarily is. Sometimes we can pick up Dhamma books and we think, well, this is really profound. And say, why is it profound? Because I can't understand a word of it. And then we see something like, don't create bad karma, do good karma. Oh, that's just for kids. You know, I've been studying Buddhism for too long. I mean, I don't need to know that kind of stuff. But it's what you really need is this, the humility of being the new student every day, never being an expert. And my students who've come with me from Thailand will often hear me relating an anecdote about Albert Einstein. And towards the end of his life, greatest scientist on the planet, most famous scientist on the planet, most immediately recognizable scientists on the planet with the long hair and the moustache and everything, you know. And he went to some seminar, and behind stage somebody asked him, who are you? And he said very simply, I'm a student of physics. And that's just such a wonderful response to me that instead of saying, don't you know who I am, or at least wanting to say that, you know, I've got two Nobel Prizes, or however, I'm the most famous scientist in the world, you know, I've forgotten more about physics yesterday than you'll ever learn in your whole life. And he said, I'm a student of physics. And this is the attitude that I would suggest would stand you well in Dhamma practice. Never be a Dhamma expert. Don't go to the other extent and say, oh, I'm so stupid, I don't understand anything, because that's a form of pride as well. So there are different kinds of pride and conceit. You know, some people are proud and being special and being very good at everything. Other people are proud at being hopeless, and it's a very perverse kind of pride. I don't know in Malaysia, when I was at school, if you're a boy, you have to be top or you have to be bottom. You know, the worst thing you can be as a boy is in the middle of the class. It's kind of, you know, you've either got to be outrageously good or really terrible and notorious. You know, there's no middle ground. So these are kinds of conceit that can arise. So we're interested in this very basic challenge of abandoning the unwholesome and developing the wholesome. And in one of his teachings to the Sangha, the Lord Buddha said that the monk in the noble lineage of the Sangha is a monk who derives great joy from abandoning the unwholesome and developing the wholesome. And this is a teaching which gives us a very good reminder that there is, I would call it a hierarchy of happiness, and that there are certain, there are different levels of happiness, and some are compatible, and some are not. And for the beginner and someone who's just starting out on spiritual life, it seems, oh, you've got to give this up, and you've got to give that up, and all these things that give me so much pleasure, I can't do these anymore. And you can feel it, this kind of shrinking and this kind of fear, and it all seems so kind of black and uninviting. But the actual experience, if you take the plunge through that informed faith that I mentioned just now, that you can do it and you should do it and you must do it, that nothing else is worth doing, then you find that just as certain kinds of pleasure and happiness that you once cherished slip away, other forms of happiness take their place. Because as human beings, we can't live without happiness. And the secret of a long monastic life, I would say, you know, if there's any one secret, well, there are probably, you know, a few key points, but one is you have to enjoy it. You have to really be happy as a monk. And the monks who stay a long time, you know, the monks are really happy to be monks. If they're just sort of gritting their teeth and fighting defilements and just saying, oh, it's all suffering, you can't do that for very long, really. But the kinds of happiness become more refined. And as I say, you can start to develop a real sense of joy when you see defilements and things falling away. And you can experience real joy when you start to see beautiful qualities, spiritual qualities that weren't there before, suddenly appearing. And here, there's another trap that you can fall into. You can start to feel, I shouldn't take any joy in the good qualities I have. I'll get really stuck up and proud and conceited. But that doesn't follow. And in fact, the Buddha was constantly teaching us to be intelligent and clever in ways of bringing up positive emotion in the heart as a fuel to enable a practice which is consistent, not just for the few days on a meditation retreat, but throughout months and years. And the ability to recognize the goodness and the noble qualities that are starting to flourish in your heart, not as your possession, but just as beautiful parts of nature that are starting to appear within your body and mind, then this is something that gives the mind a great buoyancy. Now, I use that word buoyancy. deliberately, and I feel it's a good translation of a very key Pali term, which is Pamoja. Now, in his teaching, sometimes the Buddha would give these long strings of connected dhammas. And in many of these strings of dhammas, you'll notice that they start off in at different points, and then on a certain level they converge. And in all those teachings which lead on to samadhi and to wisdom and to transcendence and freedom from dukkha, in other words, in the systematic and concerted effort to develop and cultivate good karma, the convergence point is this pamoja, or well-being, or buoyancy. All meditation techniques, they have to converge there. So whatever technique you're using, it has to get to this point of well-being. And from well-being, the next stage is, as that well-being matures, becomes stronger, it develops into piti, or rapture. Rapture develops into sukha, or happiness. Sukha leads to samadhi. Samadhi leads to the yathabhuta jnana dasana, seeing things as they are, which leads to a sense of revulsion or disenchantment with attachment and defilement, and leads to letting go and to ultimately to liberation. So this progression is interesting and worthy of a lot of attention on many levels. Firstly, as I said, this point that you have to reach that sense of well-being and buoyancy. And secondly, that the immediate conditioning factor for the samadhi, which leads to wisdom and vipassana on the level of abandoning defilements, is sukha. So I may perhaps call this central paradox of Buddha Dhamma, that only the happy mind can understand suffering. And this is perhaps the most important rationale for the development of samatha and for the emphasis on developing wholesome dhammas in daily life, that without the happiness and that intense sense of well-being, then the mind is not strong enough to look into the chasm or over the cliff edge of the three characteristics for very long. You know, you can maybe get to a point and you just suddenly you find yourself 10, 15 yards away from the cliff edge. What happened? You know, so there's so much fear and deep-rooted, non-conceptual, instinctual attachment which doesn't answer to reason and logic and analysis, but has to be treated with this fortification of positive emotion. And this is all this is where we see the importance of giving, sharing, generosity, helping others, keeping precepts. All these things are working together to create this sense of safety and self-respect and stability, which allows you to open and let go. So, are the jhanas, are they dukkha? You see? Well, yes, but how? If the jhanas are these incredibly blissful states with Biti and Sukha and all these qualities, how could they be dukkha? How could they be suffering? Well, on one or two occasions, the Buddha said they're like a glimpse of what Nibbana might be, but at the same time, that you know, they're not Nibbana, and they don't necessarily lead to Nibbana, because they're still in the conditioned world. They're not the unconditioned. So it's the unconditioned which is the Nibbana element and which is the true and ultimate happiness. So when we're living in the world and we're beginning to see we need to be experiencing some level of happiness, and if we're not pursuing the wholesome forms of happiness gladly and willingly, then we'll be pursuing unwholesome forms. Or if we're pursuing wholesome forms of happiness but we're not totally committed and we just think it's kind of good for us, then every now and again the mind will jump out and sort of want a holiday. And so this is a common feature of many people's spiritual life, that they start to look on meditation and practice as kind of work. And we have this kind of work-play dichotomy in our minds. So we've done a lot of work, so therefore we deserve some play. And put a lot of work into a retreat, and then after a retreat you deserve a rest. You put in a lot of good work there. And we have to see the fallacy in that way of looking at our life. And notice that we're always looking at our experience, looking at ourselves, looking at the Dhamma through certain frames of reference, frames of understanding. And we have to make those frames conscious. And we can easily fall into traps if we're not aware of the fact that what we're seeing is not pure experience. It's always through a lens, through a frame. And the experiences we have in spiritual life are very clear examples of this. Now, the way that my teacher taught the Four Noble Truths was not one where he would give a great deal of intellectual analysis, although every now and again he would give explanatory discourses, but his favorite way of teaching would be to frustrate his disciples. So not to give you something that you want and then see what happens. So you can only do that if you're very confident in your in yourself as a teacher. And it's a kind of teaching also which is only really possible when most of the or all of the disciples believe that teacher is enlightened. If you're not enlightened, or if you are and nobody believes you are, it can be a disastrous way of teaching. Luckily, Ajahn Chah did have that kind of parami and was able to do that. So you'd be waiting for... I'll give you an example. I mean, just a very simple example. We eat one meal a day in the forest monasteries, get up 3 o'clock in the morning chanting, meditation, 5 o'clock, sometimes walking 3, 4, 5 kilometers, sometimes more, come back with a bowl full of sticky rice, very heavy, haven't eaten for 24 hours. Some days you've worked maybe 5, 6 hours of hard physical work. So you can probably imagine by the time your daily meal comes around, you're pretty hungry. And the practice was that after alms round, there would be a period of something like half an hour or 45 minutes, even an hour, before the meal is offered. And we would sit in the dining hall. We were asked to meditate. And it's very difficult to meditate in those kinds of, as you feel very hungry and you'll be very sensitive to the clock and sounds of people coming. And Ajahn Chah would have always a number of guests who would be coming to offer the food. And after all the food had been distributed, which was a cause of a great dukkha in itself, in that you had no control about what you ate. All the monks had to get up off their seats and take a big pot of curry or whatever and walk down the line and just slop it into people's bowls. And so you couldn't say, I don't want this, I don't want that. You just got whatever was in your bowl and you sat down again. So that was already one teaching. But then you sit down afterwards, and Ajahn Chah would speak with the lay people, say a few words, and then his signal that it was that the conversation was over was he'd clear his throat, and then he'd give the blessing. And so I can remember a number of occasions, you know, we'd be sitting there, and he would be speaking with lay people, and then suddenly go, and then all the monks would just supposedly meditating. They would all, immediately, everybody's, raring to go, really. And then some days he would then start to talk again. And it was and you put your hands down again. And a few more minutes and go, and he'd start talking again. So this was a way that he would integrate these actually very important teachings into just the everyday details, of our life as monks. Rather than giving a very detailed sort of Abhidhamma analysis of the relationship between the different noble truths, he said, what's happening here? I'm suffering. Why am I suffering? Is Ajahn Chah making me suffer? Well, no, not really. I'm suffering because I'm hungry. I want to eat, and I can't eat until he gives the... I want something, I'm not getting it, and I don't like it, you see? And these are the kinds of teachings that you'd be getting again and again as a young monk, seeing how suffering arising because of tanha, of craving. It's not something that anybody's doing to you. The immediate trigger for suffering may lie outside of yourself, but the true cause is coming from within. So, you're put on the spot. You have to find ways of dealing with that. And often it's just a way, for me, the most effective way was just changing the frame, having that mindfulness to recognize what's going on, and then reframing it all and just saying, whenever Ajahn Chah, whenever Lumpur is ready, that's fine with me. It's only 8 o'clock in the morning, we don't have to eat till 12, we've got another 4 hours. I can wait. I'm not going to suffer about this. I'm just going to be patient. So sometimes having these ideals and through it can be very useful, because as a monk, the virtue that's being drummed into you again and again and again and again is to be patient. To learn how to endure, to be patient with, to peacefully coexist with the unpleasant. And so, yeah, I can endure this, it's not so bad. And I'm developing patience. I'm developing one of the most important virtues just by sitting here and waiting and not getting agitated. So seeing it as a Dhamma practice rather than just following the craving and the desire, just to switch like a recognition of what's going on. The actual situation's not changed, but by being able to bring up that mindfulness, re-establish attention, and then through the use of wise reflection, looking again, interpreting the situation in a new way. And the bad karma, which you're creating through the frustration and the thoughts of aversion, is just turned on its head, and good karma can take its place. So what's becoming you know, a cauldron of dukkha can turn into path of sukha. So when we have these goals of freedom from greed, hatred, and delusion, and seeing that the small happinesses and pleasures of daily life are not absolutely necessary to us, that there are other kinds of happiness that we can access very easily if we establish our mindfulness well. This gives us a great deal of confidence in our spiritual life. So Ajahn Chah would be pointing out to us again, he said that there are certain kinds of happiness that lead to more happiness, and certain kinds of happiness that lead to suffering, certain kinds of suffering that lead to more suffering, and certain kinds of happiness that lead suffering that leads to happiness. So if we're just reacting to situations and following the pleasant and avoiding the unpleasant as an unconscious kind of strategy for getting through life, the dukkha that we experience is never going to diminish. But when we have that ability to stop and calmly look at what's happening and evaluate what's happening in terms of the growth or decline of greed, hatred, and delusion, the growth and decline of generosity, compassion, wisdom, we have we are plugged into the middle path. We have a clear understanding of how to proceed. The actual details and the particular practices, the particular reflections, will depend a great deal on the situation and your own level of wisdom and experience. But we can just turn things over so easily with that power of mindfulness, wise reflection, and ability to calm the mind, to develop these practices. We need to be applying ourselves to it all the time. So, you know, what kind of Dhamma practice can you do in a meeting when there's a lot going on? You know, you can't just sit there and watch your breath. You can do. You probably get the sack, or you know, you're expected to contribute and to speak and to listen. So, if your idea of Dhamma practice is watching a rising and falling or sensations in your body, you're going to be stuck there. So although mindfulness is a constant and is needed in every situation, the object of mindfulness needs to be varied according to circumstance. So if you're alone and you don't have any kind of time constraints, you can just develop some awareness of the body, the physical movement. If you're in a social situation or in a meeting when people are talking, you can develop mindfulness of the emotions that arise. Somebody praises you, somebody blames you, somebody says something you think is stupid, somebody says something you think is wonderful. Noticing what's arising. When you have to speak, do you feel self-conscious? Are you anxious about people's reaction? Are you paranoid? Are you? How do you respond to praise? How do you respond to criticism? These are all things that we have to be developing mindfulness and awareness of. And this is how we're developing the good karma and abandoning the bad karma in our daily life. So when you see the importance of karma and good karma and bad karma, and not just dismissing it as kind of ABC basic nursery school, kindergarten Buddhism, but it's absolutely essential to every level. And taking on that teaching of karma and reflecting on it again and again can have quite revolutionary effect on your life. Certainly you see, I just don't have time, to get angry over just something like that. I mean, life's too short. I don't, and every time I get angry, it's increasing that anger rut in my mind and taking me, further away from Nibbana, further away from peace, further away from true happiness. Every single action, every single volitional movement of my mind and word I say has an effect. It's not a system of reward and punishment. It's just a natural phenomenon. Let's take an example. You're working with somebody who is annoying, or you find annoying, and you try to be patient, and you have a real strong urge as soon as that person walks out of the room to criticize him or her to your best friend. Isn't he obnoxious? Isn't she this? Isn't she that? You're able to restrain that urge, but then one day it's just too much. Finally, your patience snaps. The person walks out of the room and you start to run them down, and then that person says, "Yeah, and that's even worse when they have the same kind of aversion, because there's nothing like two friends for feeding unwholesome dhammas. When you both think you're right and they're wrong. So beware that feeling I'm right as well, because that's a really dangerous feeling. So you let it all out and you feel quite good about that. But notice that if that same thing happens again the next day, it's that much easier and that much more likely that you will criticize and gossip about that person behind their back. And the third time and fourth time becomes easier and easier. And so something which really went against the grain, and something that you really had a sense of shame strong sense, I should restrain myself here, in a matter of a few days, has completely disappeared. So in mathematics, we know like if you're making a jump from 0 to 1, 1 to 2, 2 to 3, it's an equal gap. But psychologically, the gap from 0 to 1 is huge. But the gap from 1 to 2 is not very wide at all. And the gap from 2 to 3 to 3 to 4 is almost indistinguishable. And this is how habits and bad habits arise, just little by little, little by little. And suddenly we have this idea of who we are, and then we suddenly find people have a very different idea of who we are. Have you ever heard that somebody says, "Well, you're that kind of person"? And you say, "No, I'm not. I'm not like that at all." And then you think, "Well, why do they think we're like that?" And you realize that they're judging you on your actions and speech. Well, you're judging yourself on who you think you are, or who you'd like to be, or who you think you should be, and who you were some time ago. So you say, "Well, have you noticed now when people are, particularly in America, they're arrested for some terrible crime, and they'll say, 'Well, this isn't really me. This isn't the real me who's doing this.'" So there's this idea: there's this real me who's very virtuous, and this person who does and says nasty things is not really me. That's some kind of false surrogate self. But in the law of karma, it's what you do, what you say, not your idea about yourself, which counts. Every single moment of the day, you have that choice, to go the path, the middle way, or to follow greed, hatred, and delusion. And that's why our lives have so much meaning and significance, you know. And see that the meaning of our life is not something to be measured by income, by how big a house you have, how big a car you've got, how big a bank account, and so on, how famous you are. What's in the balance is what you've done, what you've said, what you've thought about, what you've dwelt upon, what you've taken pleasure in, what you've enjoyed. This is the karmic result of every day of our life. So even if you're retired, you're no longer working, you're no longer making money, and in a modern capitalist society, you're somehow considered to be not, you know, a fully functioning member of society if you're not making money these days. But if you're making good karma, then you say you're an extremely productive member of society. So the path and the goal can seem very far away, but the action, you know, small action, moment by moment, what are you thinking about? What are you taking interest in? What are you delighting in? What are you doing? What are you saying? These are basic practices, but they're also, in the long term, the most profound. So we know, I'm a meditator. I really think meditation is a good thing, and then so on and so forth. And say, well, do you meditate every day? Well, almost. You know, and well, how long? Well, I used to. Yeah, I know. But today, I'm not talking about yesterday or a month ago, or you know, how long you used to. What are you doing right now? This is karma. So seeing, looking closely, really closely at happiness and suffering, pleasure and pain in daily life. This is the grounding in everyday experience, which really sustains this path of practice and the abandonment of the wholesome, development of the wholesome. It's something we can all do. You know, there's nothing here which is beyond any of you. You say, oh, I can't do that. And I say, well, can you try to do that? Yeah, who is there here who can't try to do something? And that's the good karma, the trying. Yeah, you can be successful, very successful, sometimes not so successful, but it's the effort, the sincerity, the trying to do something, and being proud of that. You know, taking joy in the fact, I'm someone who tries. Yeah, sometimes I get angry, sometimes I get jealous, sometimes I say stupid things, but I'm trying to reduce the amount of greed, hatred, and delusion in my life. I'm trying to increase and to cultivate the qualities of generosity and inner peace and loving kindness and all those virtues, and most especially wisdom. Learning to use wisdom more and more rather than just following desire. So as long as you see, this is really wonderful, I got to have this, if I don't have this, I won't have anything else. You see, and then you're already setting yourself up for dukkha. Because if you say, no, this wonderful and really enjoyable experience, I'm not going to do. I'm a Buddhist practitioner. I'm going to say no. Just say no. No. Okay. But then you say, now I said no with this, and I should say at least yes to that, just to make up for it. And then you say no, 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 and then sometime yes, you know. And your yes is, you know, makes up for all the no's. And so what's the problem? You know, how do you go beyond that? Instead of saying, oh, I'm hopeless, I try to do it, I can't do it, other people can do it, but I just, all this bad karma from past lives, I don't know. But stop. Just re-examine what's happening. What is the basic cause here? Basic cause is you're giving a value to that. Your initial mistake is saying, this is so wonderful, this is so great, this is so important, this is so enjoyable. And so if you have this feeling that I'm not enjoying something I really enjoy, you're setting up an inner conflict, and usually, you know, you're going to succumb and then feel guilty and terrible afterwards. But the movement of wisdom, which is facilitated by the mindfulness that just stops that kind of initial reaction and going into that rut, and you're saying, is it really so wonderful? Is it really going to give me what I want? What is it I really want? So my belief is that deep, deep in our hearts, what we really, really want is Nibbana. We want true, unconditioned happiness, freedom from suffering. And our mistake is that we're rushing around seeking for happiness in sex and power and money and all these kind of things. And all that kind of crazy and futile kind of running around and running around in circles is a repression of the fundamental desire for Nibbana. So I would say Sigmund Freud, like so many of the great Western thinkers, got things, you know, completely upside down. You know, for him, religious impulses and everything were all a repression of the sexual instinct. So I'm saying it's the other way around, that this weird kind of mad desire for sex and enjoyment and everything is a repression of the fundamental, deep-seated desire and need for Nibbana. So we say, well, is this really going to give me what I want? Have we ever had it before? Did it do it for me? How happy was I? For how long was I happy? You know? And what happened after it wore off? Then I needed more. And then you have this, the law of diminishing returns. This much can give you a certain amount of pleasure. After a while, you have to increase the amount, increase the amount, increase the amount. Is there really any end to it? Is there any real satisfaction to it? So using the mind, which can calm the whirlwind of desire and all this madness of thinking, and calming the mind, stilling the mind, and then really looking at the objects of desire, and seeing that as long as there is this craving here, then we'll never truly be satisfied. Is that true? You know, it's not that we have to believe that, because the Buddha said, but it's like this is the working hypothesis we have, that following this craving is never going to give us what we truly want, but letting go of that craving will. Is that true? Does that ring true with our experience? So this is path of abandonment of unwholesome dhammas, because clearly seeing the unsatisfactory nature of them, cultivating wholesome dhammas of body, speech and mind, cultivating wholesome kamma, we're seeing the beauty, the nobility of it, and the fact that good and wholesome kamma leads to the ultimate. You can't just jump from the unwholesome to the ultimate. You have to go from unwholesome to ultimate. You know, that's the law of nature. So I think I've spoken longer than I was invited to, so I apologize if you're writhing around on the floor, and I'd like to end the talk at this point. Thank you.